Oi, oi, it's your boy, the Aaron Burr of 19th century slurs. Jack Slack, it's the Jack Slack pod. Oh, no, it isn't. It's the Boycast. We're on the Boycast. It's a slightly less formal version of the podcast. The only way the actual podcast could get less formal is if I were, like, clipping my toenails while I was recording. But it's a more jumbled mess of a podcast. But you know that. You're a boy. Today, we got some fights coming up. We got... we got Lewis versus Dorcas is the name of the card, but there's a lot more going on than that main event. I think every time I see a Derek Lewis main event, I think, phoning it the fuck in. Because I know that the UFC knows that, like, he does numbers based on the My Balls Was Hot meme. People tune in and they're like, oh, it's that guy from the meme. Hoping for a new meme. Honestly, the amount of mileage you can get on a meme as a fighter. Leon Edwards desperately needs a meme, is what I'm saying. A meme aside from, like, being the bad luck Brian of welterweight MMA. But this card's actually pretty good. But I'll tell you what wasn't pretty good and what I want to talk about today. Because I spent time watching this piece of shit. I'm going to get some content out of it. Halle Berry's Bruised. A masterclass in appreciation of Rocky. It's just that watching this film made me realize how good Rocky is. Now, Rocky is a masterpiece, and I did think about doing like a full history episode on Rocky, the making of Rocky, and then like talking, you know, academic assessments of Rocky. But Rocky is, if you have a wife or girlfriend who's never seen Rocky and doesn't give a shit about combat sports, it's a hard sell because you're going like, no, it's a film about people, it's a film about poverty. It's one of the all-time great screenplays that they give you in, like, film school to look at. Because every character's built up quick without, like, shit-tier exposition. You know, they've all got their own little arcs. And all of them are very flawed people. But it comes out at the end and you go, oh, what a great film. The boxing in it is shit. However, in Halle Berry's Bruised, and there's going to be a couple of shockers in this review, I think one of the saving graces is the actual fighting. And I think that generally the film is pretty bad. I think either my expectations got lower as the film went on, or it started very weak and got better. I think it wasn't helped by immediately shoehorning in this kid. She's Jackie Justice. Have a laugh about that. Get over it. I'm going to say it a lot, but fucking hell, who leaves that in the final draft of the script? Jackie Justice is a disgraced MMA fighter. She was at one point in the UFC, but in her one UFC fight, and they show it from the first person, she gets beat up and she jumps up and climbs out of the cage, which, you know, I have never seen it happen, but pretty cool way to have your character be disgraced. Because in MMA, you know, it's quite hard to actually disgrace yourself. Like, aside from Matt Serra's brother refusing to come out of the butt scoot, you know, you could pretty much get away with whatever and people would just go, oh yeah, he was an MMA fighter at one point. People fondly remember Bob Schreiber, who was, I mean, his name is Filthy Bob Schreiber, but he was a filthy cheat and people love talking about Bob Schreiber. Taught Stefan Struve and Aleister Black, or Malachi Black as he is now, the pro wrestler. Who, if you've never seen him, awesome wheel kicks in a pro wrestling context. It's really impressive that he does them, lands them, and doesn't seriously hurt people on the regular. But anyway, Jackie Justice, returning to that, is a disgraced MMA fighter. She climbed out of the cage. You have these shots of her, like, sitting outside a bodega? We'd call it a corner shop in the UK. And they don't have chairs outside of them. But then someone comes up and goes, yo, it's Jackie Justice, man. You got disgraced, and starts filming her. And I don't think people actually do that. But she's working as like a cleaner or a maid I think cleaner is probably a better word for like rich families. She's changing in a back room and like the kid of the family is filming her in like a really theatrical way that I don't think would ever happen. Like, he just walks into the room and has his hand like out straight so that you can see the phone of him filming it. Like, no, he would be hiding behind the door filming that. But she's like, are you filming me again? And she hits an Osotogari and then throws his phone on the floor and stamps on it a few times. cut to the next, or the evening, or the next day, whatever. She's lost the job, obviously. And her boyfriend and manager, whose name in the film is, hold on, Desi, played by Adan Canto, best known for his role as Sunspot in X-Men Days of Future Past, which I haven't watched. He is a Gordon Ryan type figure. If you watch this film, you'll be like, oh man, it's Gordon Ryan. But he plays the manager of Jackie Justice and boyfriend. They fucking. And when she tells him about this, he goes, was that necessary? And she says it was super necessary. And at that point, my balls shriveled up inside me. And I died slowly from the inside, and I turned the film off. And then I came back to it later and tried to finish watching it. He goes to some club, underground fight club, to look at this new fighter called like She-Wolf or something. Hold on, what's the name? They've all got fucking stupid names. Werewolf. And Werewolf is played by Gabby Garcia. Gabby Garcia, who, you know, had a hard time being taken seriously, because she was the best rapper in the world at her weight, but there was no one even close to her weight. She took a lot of drugs, but she was already a giantess. And there are tons of male fighters who took just as many drugs as her, and they don't get shat on in anywhere near the same way. Allegedly. Oh, no, did she get caught? Tentatively say allegedly. But, you know, there was that whole period where she lost a load of weight, looked good, was, you know, being groomed by Rizin to be a star. And, you know, that sort of went down the tubes. But, yeah, this at the fight club, Werewolf beats up someone and they say, oh, Jackie Justice, you should fight her. And Jackie Justice goes, that's a man. And you're like, well, doesn't that just undo everything that Gabby Garcia has been trying to do about her representation? But never mind. They do fight Gabby. Gabby beats her up briefly. And then Jackie Justice takes her down, mounts her, gets on top and headbutts her into a pulp. Which is quite cool. You don't see enough headbutts in films. But I think she does a dope-ass judo throw or like a flying sweep or something. I can't remember how she gets it there. But it's weird because like a lot of that fight seems to be like her striking. And then later in the film, they're like, you're a grappler. Don't try and strike. But anyway, Werewolf was going to be signed to... Immaculate comes over. And Immaculate is Shannon Knapp. Shannon Knapp is the very ordinary looking woman in her 40s or 50s who owns Invicta or runs Invicta. But for this film, the owner of Invicta is, I suppose you'd say, a very drippy guy nowadays. But a black dude in a big fur coat with like leather gloves on that match the colour of the coat. And it's all red or pink or whatever. I can't remember he was wearing. And he claps like he holds one hand up facing down and then he holds the other hand over it facing down and taps the back of his hand. Like that. And he does that about four times in the film and it really got on my tits. But Immaculate, he comes in and he goes, well, she was about to fight for Invicta. Now you've got to fight for Invicta. And she goes, oh no. And he says, go and see Budokai, my trainer. And she turns up and you're expecting an Asian dude, Mr. Miyagi. And it turns out it's some lass from Hackney. And she's like a meditate-y person. But yeah, then there's some training scenes. It's really bad. Halle Berry throws up in all the training and stuff. Oh, fuck. I forgot to do the crux of the film. I've been saying that Rocky is a great film because it's a poverty story and not a boxing story. The poverty story of this film is that Jackie Justice's mum turns up and goes, see that boy over there? That's your son. Which I thought they were going to do straight face. A you didn't know you had a kid movie, but with a woman. And I thought that's just the best idea for a movie ever. Do you not remember giving birth? But no, in fact, she did give birth and put this child up for adoption. Oh no, she left the child with the father. And then the father died and then the child comes to her. So through this whole film, the child is sort of ignored and then comes center stage for little bits where she says cringe things like, you're little and I'm big. Big protects little. That's the whole of that for the film until the end when she says, you did it, little helped big or whatever it was. It was awful. But that's the reason she has to take this fight for $10,000 or whatever it is. It's a title shot against the Invicta champion, Lady Killer. Whose actual name in the film is Lucia Chavez. I don't know why they made Valentina Shevchenko Argentinian, but they did. She probably said, I want to wear a weird wig. And they were like, yeah, cool, go for it. Because I think she's a redhead in this. I don't know how that makes her any more Argentinian. But anyway, the whole thing is just a mashup of weird decisions. Jackie's life's a mess. She's getting close to the time to fight. And she shags her coach, which was... There are two things that this film portrays about women's MMA very well. One is that Immaculate reveals that he loses his temper at her for missing training, and he reveals that she's only been brought in as a can to make the champion look good, which is hilarious when you slapped the real Invicta name on it. And Invicta literally did that with Michelle Waterson when they brought in a 47-year-old Japanese woman to lose to her in Michelle Waterson's most effective striking performance to date. But the second part they got right about women's MMA is that the coach ends up shagging the fighter. So in this instance, the coach is a woman named, her name's not actually Budokan. Her name is Bobby, but they end up shagging, and then Bobby falls off the wagon and becomes an alcoholic again. There's not a lot of upbeatness to this movie. But then, Rocky didn't have a whole lot of upbeatness, and that was still a great movie. So Immaculate reveals that she's actually being bust in as a bum to lose. And the whole time, Bobby Budokan is going, you're a grappler, you've got to get her to the ground. Now, I'm losing track of what happened for the rest of this film, but the important point is that she breaks up with Desi, the Gordon Ryan chap. She goes to the title fight, and here's the kicker that you weren't expecting. The highlight of this film is Valentina Shevchenko's stunt acting. Genuinely. She carried Halle Berry to an okay fight scene. I was actually genuinely impressed, because I know how hard it is to make stuff look good on film. I'm a big fan of Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Donnie Yen, all that stuff, and Tony Jaa. It is an art making things look good on film. Watch an episode of SmackDown, and if the camera angle changes when someone's doing something, you'll realize they're coming nowhere close. So in a movie, it's about knowing where the cameras are, how you're doing, how things are going to look from those particular perspectives, and then building the fight scene around there, where you'll look like you're hitting the person really hard, and you're not. And she did that really well with a 55-year-old Halle Berry who doesn't do any martial arts and had no idea what she was doing. She made it look like Halle Berry actually did know what she was doing. They're flowing through all these ground positions, sit-outs, coming up behind each other and stuff. And, Valentina's kicks look real, and they're actually... I mean, she's coming closer on a lot of these strikes than she does in her actual fights, but... No, genuinely, I was quite impressed by Halle Berry. I wasn't impressed by Halle Berry's MMA. By Valentina Shevchenko. She really did carry the last 15 minutes of this movie, 20 minutes of this movie. I would say one of the things that is just crazy, that you always remember whenever you see an actress or an actor in person or a face, someone who's been on the big screen, when you meet them in person, one, they're always smaller than you imagine because you've seen them on a big screen. Two, movie people are so much more attractive than regular attractive people. Because Valentina Shevchenko, not the best looking fighter in the UFC, but people, she's all right, but stood next to Halle Berry, who is 55 and looks incredible for it. You're just like, wow, one of these people is clearly a movie star. And you get that sort of sense with everyone else in the movie. They're not as attractive as Halle Berry. You're like, well, yeah, okay. One of these people is working at a much higher pay grade than the rest of them. You do get a bit of Halle Berry booby in this movie and a bit of Bobby Budokan booby in this movie. They have a little sex scene. Doesn't really save the movie, but, if you're into that. When was the last time we saw a Monsters Ball? When she won an Oscar, and then you watch this and you're like, how did you win an Oscar? But then it's like, Al Pacino. Your skills do fade with age unless you're Daniel Day-Lewis. Or Robert De Niro, as Doug Stanhope said, he used to be in films, or good films. And then the other thing that was hilarious about it, that Invicta signed off on looking like they feed their champions bums, which they have in the past. But then they also had Judy Kedzie and Eve Edwards as the commentators on the show. And Judy Kedzie does the matchmaking for Invicta. So pretty funny, but never mind. Don't watch this film. It's absolute shite. Go and watch Rocky again and make your other half watch it. So that is my review of Bruised. I should probably give it a score. It wasn't 1 out of 10 bad. It wasn't ironically enjoyable. It did pick up towards the end. I was slightly... It's the best thing I've seen Valentina Shevchenko do. And they paid Gabby Garcia, and she struggles to get fights. So, net, was it a good... Oh, no, they got Kat Zingano to turn down a fight to be in the film, and they fired her from the UFC for that, and then they didn't want her in the film because she wasn't in the UFC. So, yeah, it hasn't been a net good. It's a net evil. Yeah. Do not watch. Bad. For good alternative content on the same platform, Arcane is surprisingly good. Not an MMA thing, but worth touching on. Actually, people like when I talk about gaming anyway. I have played some League of Legends, like everyone else, and cut it out of my life when I realized that you play a game, it takes 40 minutes, you've got no control over like the outcome of the game unless you're playing carry, and there's no point, you know, you're never going to get a game where you're playing carry. And it just makes you angry, you know. So I've been on the single player games for quite a while now, but... the one upside is that Riot do have a ton of money, and they offloaded their license to these people who made Arcane. Amazing animation, decent story, well put together, random fucking montage every episode with Imagine Dragons music over it. Don't know what that's about. But yeah, genuinely, really enjoyed it. Go watch that. Do not watch Cowboy Bebop remake. The thing that annoyed me most about that was that when they were announced they were doing the remake, they let the original go from the Netflix library. You're like, why not keep that around and then people will watch it? And then they brought it back when they got brought back the live action one. And the effect of the live action one was that everyone watched the first episode of it and went, damn, I should watch the original series again, and then watch the original series. So a very expensive way to renew interest in Cowboy Bebop, but they did. Anyway, let's talk about some fights that are going on this weekend. Boop, boop, boo. Only a UFC. Oh, we do actually have the boxing match between Jake Paul and Tyron Woodley. Tyron Woodley 2. There you go. I said that Tyron Woodley would never get that rematch and that he'd just tattooed Jake Paul's name on his finger for nothing. All it took was Tommy Fury realizing at the last minute that he's not a good boxer and pulling out of this fight. And now Tyron Woodley's going to make another $1 million or whatever. So good for him. Or $500,000, I think they said he's going to get. But it would be pretty much par for the course in combat sports if he now knocked out Jake Paul in this one. But he's been in so many fights saying the next time he'll let his hands go. I think he's pretty much incapable of it at this point. But I'm looking forward to it nonetheless. Just to watch people who are really like concerned with MMA's legitimacy. Getting upset about it. I mean, I get, like, the Filthy Casual's Guide to Jose Aldo is doing really well at the moment. It's done over 400,000 views, which is mad. So I'm going to start doing shorter, less formal Filthy Casual's Guides because that's what that one was, and it seems to have done amazingly. Whereas I spent ages on previous ones and not got any views. But that's brought me into contact with a large portion of the Great Unwashed and people who don't really know anything about MMA. But they're all like, MMA striking is dog shit. This doesn't even work in kickboxing. You're like, well, it does work in kickboxing. You're just assuming it doesn't work in kickboxing. You don't watch any kickboxing. It's happening all the time in fucking J-Kick. And the guy who brought the calf kick into ATT learned it from his Muay Thai coach, who used it in Muay Thai fights. Chad Dundas did a great article on the history of the calf kick, actually, where he talked to... I can't remember his name. He's got a good... DVD out or instructional out on Fanatics about the calf kick, which I was watching the other day going, yeah, this is really good. But yeah, I think it was Wilson Govea was the first guy from that gym to use it in about 2009. He'd come out of the UFC, lost his first fight out of the UFC. Then for his next fight, he just decided to use the calf kick and blew this guy's leg apart and then mounted him and finished him. But anyway, as I was saying, when I see people being like, MMA fighters just suck. You know, these kicks don't exist in kickboxing and Muay Thai. I do feel that pang of like, I just want to jump in and call this person an idiot. But I, you know, try and hold off most of the time. But equally, people who are obsessed with like Ben Askren's going to box up Jake Paul need the reality check, to be honest. So it's always quite funny watching these things play out. But it would be a nice turnaround for Tyron to... pull off a big... Well, I suppose it's an upset now. How crazy is that? You've gone from this guy is chasing GSP, coming close for the coming after the record for best welterweight ever, and now he's the underdog against Jake Paul in a boxing match. But then the unspoken factor is that Jake Paul's actually pretty decent at boxing for someone who is, I suppose he's a professional boxer because he's making more money than most professional boxers do. But, someone who took up boxing as a hobbyist fairly late in the day, he's not bad. So this UFC card, Derek Lewis versus Chris Dawkus is your main event. Chris Dawkus, brother of friend of the show, Kyle Dawkus. It's a hard show to be a friend of if you're a professional fighter. Someone left a comment on the Pena versus Nunes episode earlier this week being like, oh shit, I sometimes train with Juliana Pena and I told her to check out this podcast. And all you've done is shit on her. And I was like, oh yeah, that's probably not great. I suppose the way to think of it is that we're talking about fights at the highest level. I expect, I compare everything to the absolute highest level, and the level of the top of the women's bantamweight division isn't great. But I train with them and am friends with many fighters who are better, obviously much better than me, but far below the standard that we're talking about, like when we're talking about Peter Yan and shit like that, the best fighters in the world. If I was talking to them or talking about them, I probably wouldn't be as dismissive of them as I am of fighters in the UFC who aren't as good as the other fighters in the UFC. It's a context thing is what I'm saying. But yes, brother, a friend of the show. Chris Dawkus, interesting, because he's been really busy. He's had 4 fights in the UFC already, 4 finishes, 4 wins. And he's done it all since late 2020. The way to gauge it is that he's had his 4 fights in the time it's taken him to grow a beard. Because he came in clean shaven against Parker Porter, a little bit stubbly against Nascimento, getting a beard against Oylenek, and then against Shamil Abdurakhimov, he actually had a very impressive, respectable beard going on. He's got a tough ask in this one because he's against Derek Lewis. I didn't realize he's already number 8 in the world according to the rankings, but Dawkus, this is not Lewis. But it seems like the top couple of guys in that division, there's the Cyril Garnes and Francis Ngannou's and Stipe Miocic, who we'd favor over most heavyweights just on ability, or in Ngannou's case, power and ability. But Lewis is more, he's just below him. You'd pick all 3 of those guys over him, but he's very much a spoiler. There are people he shouldn't be able to beat who he is. Like Curtis Blaydes, you looked at that first round, you're like, yeah, okay, well, he's kicking his ass on the feet and he's got better work on the ground and better takedowns. This should be all Curtis Blaydes. And then, he gets the uppercut from hell. And Volkov, obviously a much better striker. Derek Lewis doesn't have great takedowns and wasn't able to pursue them very well. Still ended up able to get him out of there. And then he's been able to smash like the Ilir Latifis and the Olynyks of the world because they're not very good. But he had, they teed him up Junior Dos Santos back in 2019 and he still managed to lose that. So massive gaping holes in his game that you can drive a truck through, but good at staying in there until he can land his one big shot. And I feel like we say this every time we're talking about Derek Lewis, and I'm kind of bored of saying it. But, you have to really walk on eggshells when you're fighting him. And that's the thing. You've got to drive the pace up. You've got to make him work. You've got to make him flinch at nothing like Mark Hunt and Junior Dos Santos did and Cyril Garn. But you've got to be convincing enough that you are actually poking him and hitting him, because otherwise he's not going to fall for the feints and he's just going to not get tired. I think for Dawkus, one of the things that I'm... impressive is the hand speed and, decent power on that hand speed too. Like, he's not winding up big blows like Derek Lewis and Francis Ngannou, but he's getting his hands there fast with heavyweight power, which is obviously an enormous problem for everyone because heavyweights are typically much slower. We're not quite at Alex Emelianenko freakish levels, but we're there's some of the fastest hands in that division, certainly in combination. I would say that I would like to see him hit the body more. He will poke the body with a front kick and he throws the odd right hand to the body, right straight to the body, which is good. But he does it so that he can then come up with the left hook or show the squaring of the body and then throw the left hook off the squaring. He doesn't tend to do it to build up attritive damage, which is what Junior Dos Santos was able to do to almost everyone, just poke him in the body over and over again. And they get tired and they start reaching down and opening big holes for overhands and stuff. So I would like to see him hit the body more, but again, tough ask against guys who can knock you out with one coming back, and that's pretty much everyone in the heavyweight division. I think for this one, lots of feints, lots of jabs, lots of calf kicks, lots of good 1-2s. Clinch up when you're done punching to stop him coming back, and to kill some time. But a big name if he can win this one. Co-main is Stephen Thompson versus Bilal Muhammad. I keep looking away and forgetting what half these fights are. Just surprising good fights out of nowhere. Stephen Thompson coming off the loss to Gilbert Burns. Obviously very sad. Would have been fun to see him get a title shot. Would have been fun to see how Kamaru Usman contends with him. But obviously, if you can't stay off the cage from when Gilbert Burns is trying to shoot in on your hips, you're not going to be able to do it against Kamaru Usman, probably. Before that, made a fool out of Jeff Neal and Vicente Luque. Both those fights really just... like, Thompson's hand speed and power is not greater than those guys. His ability to work in combination is not greater than those guys. I would say that his natural attributes are not greater than those guys. And he made them look foolish by having good footwork, good ring craft, and them not having the ability to adapt. The Jeff Neal one was absolutely maddening because he threw no low kicks. Well, you know, I think I said last week, he threw like 7 low kicks and landed all of them, but didn't really commit to them at all. But he's fighting Bilal Muhammad, remember the name. Bilal Muhammad had the no contest against Leon Edwards, fought Damian Maia, won. If there's a knock on Bilal Muhammad, it's that he's not finished anyone. The only person he's finished is Takashi Sato. But for the most part, you know, it took him 3 rounds to do that. For the most part, he is up and down with combinations, shooting it on takedowns, outworking and outscoring people. Oh, he did score a ground and pound knockout in his very first UFC win over Augusto Montano. But yeah, this is going to be a ringcraft centric fight, I imagine. Basically, this is the polar opposite of the fight that Bilal Muhammad faced in Diego Lima, who stood on the fence and basically let Muhammad go up and down with combinations and then drop on his hips when he wanted to come back. Which, you know, Bilal Muhammad didn't finish all the takedowns, didn't hold him down the whole time, but it meant that any time Diego Lima wanted to throw punches, Bilal Muhammad could just drop in on a clinch. You know, he had nowhere he could go. Whereas Stephen Thompson, very good at making sure that his back's not on the fence, generally. Wasn't so great in that Gilbert Burns fight. So, yeah, I think this will probably be a Stephen Thompson... I'm not going to say clinic, maybe a good Stephen Thompson performance. Because the other thing is that Bilal Muhammad does come in on straight lines and does present his chin quite a lot. If you watch the left hook, the counter left hook from Vicente Luque that knocked him out, absolutely perfect. But he still does that. He still sort of leads with his chin and charges people down. And the other thing is like the feints out in the open and the poking out in the open. Interesting choice of words there, Jack, because you're about to reference Leon Edwards. But Leon Edwards was able to sort of like paralyze him for periods of that first round. We didn't get a lot of that fight, which is a bit of a shame. But the one round that did happen, Leon Edwards was keeping Muhammad at bay pretty easily and scoring on him. It'd be nice to get a couple more good fights out of Stephen Thompson, to be honest, but he is 38 now. Amanda Lemos versus Angela Hill. Yeah, fun fight. I vaguely remember Amanda Lemos. She's got a couple of knockouts in her last 2 fights, I think, actually. And Angela Hill, obviously, long-time fave of the podcast. I mean, almost a 50-50 record now, but she had a very rough start at MMA, or rather in the UFC. Went back to Invicta, won a belt there, came back to the UFC, has been fighting basically every 3 months since then. And, yeah, looks good, generally. She's lost a couple of rough decisions. She's lost some fights where she's just not been good enough. But she brings some interesting tools. Basically, you've got power in Lemos versus trickiness in Hill here. Rafaela Sunsal versus Ricky Simone. Nice. It's interesting. Ricky Simone, very hittable on the feet, but one of his best performances was acting as the sprawl and brawler, even though a lot of his best work is as a wrestler. Brian Kelleher was his last matchup. Just looked too strong for Kelleher. Was able to hit nice double legs over and over and again. He's on a 3-fight winning streak now, but the fight with Ray Borg actually was a bit of a banger. I enjoyed that one. Both guys throwing combinations and body shots. It was just nice MMA boxing. But they cut Borg off that, which is sad. But then he does, you know, forever miss weight, and he is pretty much just... yeah, not going to do what you contracted him to do at any point. But Ricky Simone, obviously also famous for being the last guy to lose to Uriah Faber. Uriah Faber turned up at 40, just hit him with an overhand straight in the head. Where the distance with Rob Font, just a fun fight. I mean, he beat Mirab Dvalishvili, which we always forget. But he's got some fun boxing. He's a little bit too hittable for my liking because he's quite square and quite upright at the same time. But he's got nice level changes. And it's that sort of combination of the squaring up for the right hand with the squaring up for the double leg. So he plays them off each other and he hits just little level changes into nice run through double legs. Rafael Assuncao, meanwhile, is one of the trickiest fighters in MMA. For a very long time, he was like, why would you fight him? Because not only will he beat you by split decision, it'll be boring and no one will see it because they don't tune in for Rafael Assuncao fights. It was like, yeah, if you beat him, you get a title shot, but what's the worth? So he was on like a 4-fight winning streak when he, the people who beat him were TJ Dillashaw and Marlon Moraes, and that was it for a while. But then he's now on a 3-fight losing streak. Moraes, Sanhagen, Garbrandt. He's the only person Garbrandt's beaten in his last 5, which is always a bad look. He's had a couple of booked against rough guys, too. He was booked to fight Ronnie Barcelos, who we're going to get onto in a minute, and Kyla Phillips, who is, again, very tricky, or certainly was at the time that fight was booked a few months back. So honestly, like, might even be a little bit easier fight. Depends how much Simone goes to his wrestling. I like Assuncao's guard. I think it's very tricky, but you don't see an awful lot of it. But I think the thing is that if it stays on the feet, Assuncao has a brilliant way. I mean, it's brilliant in a very boring way, but brilliant way of lowering his opponent's output just by having the odd tricky counter, lots of stance switching, lots of staring at people from just beyond their reach. And he gets people to overreach and tries to hit him with a good counter, and then he'll sit on that for the rest of the round. And I think that's the downside of engaging a stand-up matchup with him. You could find yourself just getting drawn into that. I mean, obviously, no one trains to do that. They just go out there and fall into it. Meanwhile, in the wrestling, you know, if you confront him, firstly, you're making stuff happen all the time. So if he's conserving his energy by having these low-output fights, and he isn't actually, prepared for high-paced, frantic bouts, you might be able to gas him out. But more than that, if you take him down and you're on top of him and his guard's better than you expected or quite dangerous, or he's very good at getting up, you know, the whole time that you're on top, you're winning in the eyes of the judges, so might be safer to just take him on in that area. But driving up the pace on him could work as well. I mean, Sanhagen did. If you can walk him back towards the fence and don't let him just keep circling out and readjusting the distance, you could put him in uncomfortable spots. The bodywork Simone showed against Ray Borg was nice. He could use that here. Low kicks along the cage too, because Assuncao likes his pronounced side-on stance. I mean, I would say this is a big win for Ricky Simone if he gets it done, but again, it's like, I don't even know if you get the boost off beating Rafael Assuncao now because he's 3 in the hole and hasn't won since 2018, though, you know, his last win was Rob Font. So I'm kind of excited for that fight in a very sort of academic way. You know, nodding along going, yes, yes. The economy, yeah. At the dinner party. I will pay attention to that one, but I don't expect to be blown away by action or fun, to be honest. That's a fight I'm watching just to keep abreast of developments in my field. Diego Ferreira versus Matheus Gamrot. This is the one. That's the one that's got me going, lads. Diego Ferreira, in a weird spot because he's on a couple of losses now. The Benil Dariush fight and the Gregor Gillespie fight. Did not look bad in either of those, though. The Benil Dariush fight was a split decision loss over a guy who's now top 10, top 5, whatever he is. You know, in consideration for, I think he's in a title eliminator next. And then Gregor Gillespie, very talented guy. The Gregor Gillespie one is weird because whether it was a nefarious move or not, Diego Ferreira came in 5 pounds heavy, which is a lot. There's a lot of reasons that could be. He could have, like, not bothered trying to cut weight. He could have deliberately, you know, he could have cut weight, but also tried to come in heavy. Because if he's 5 pounds overweight and also dehydrated, that's a lot of weight that he's over. You rehydrate and that's like, you know, 20, 30 pounds on fight night. A lot of people suspected that he was trying to just come in big to deal with Gillespie. His gas tank did sort of run out on him in the second round, but then the first round was so frantic that Gregor Gillespie was gassed when he walked back to his corner. So Yeah, bit of a strange decision, but again, not going to ingratiate you with anyone. Like, if you lose this one now and they say you missed weight in your last one, they might just kick you out anyway. I should have said, actually, I forgot that fight completely because someone asked my favorite grappling matches in MMA the other day. Gregor Gillespie versus Diego Ferreira. I mean, it only happened a couple of months ago, but absolutely wild. You got a very scrambly wrestler versus a very wrestly grappler. So it was really bewilderingly quick scrambles and exchanges of grappling techniques in that bout. And even then, like his last four fights, I think he's got the crucifix on every single opponent. Carlos Ferreira, Diego Ferreira, he just hasn't really been able to capitalize on it, which is a bit of a shame, but gets to it against everyone. Got it on Dariush, got it on Gillespie, got it on Rustam Khabilov, whichever one is correct. Diego Ferreira is the kind of fighter like Ian Heinich for me, where it's like, I want to watch him defend takedowns all day. I don't want to watch him, you know, taking other people down. Not that, well, his striking is actually pretty entertaining as compared to Ian Heinich's, but I just want to watch people trying to take him down so that he can scramble. Heinich is all about the Granby. Ferreira is a good amount about the Granby, does really good hip rolls, like rolls through and unlocks the guy's hands by rolling into his elbow. Does nice elevators on the way down. There's a brilliant moment in the Dariush fight where Dariush begins to take him down. Diego Ferreira falls to his back, uses one leg to elevate Dariush and start going to the saddle, you know, elevate him into the leg attacks. And Dariush cartwheels back the other way over the top of him. Very cool fight for grappling exchanges, that one. And one that basically Diego Ferreira lost by trying to attack too much from the bottom. He got stuck there on the bottom. Well, not stuck there on the bottom. He accepted the bottom position too much. You know, that's the downside where everyone else in the world would be trying to scramble up. He's going, I'm going to throw up some triangles and stuff. And he's not quite, I think that's the magic of Charles Oliveira. He has struck that balance between, rabidly attacking from the bottom and using the movement to get up. Whereas Diego Ferreira is sort of like, he will defend a takedown well, he'll stop you getting him, or he'll fight off your takedown, he'll roll through on an omoplata or go to a crucifix or something weird on the way down. But if he's trying to attack you from the bottom, he won't get up as quickly. And you're just like, you're not going to triangle Beneil Dariush. You might be able to attack him with the triangle and move through, like someone like Charles Oliveira will do, but there was a lot of like attacking from the bottom that didn't seem to be just to get up, or you know, they didn't capitalize on by getting up in that fight. But he's full of cool scrambles like that. If you saw his Kimura trap against Gillespie, that was awesome. Gets the Kimura while falling to the mat, turns Gillespie over. Gillespie rolls up into him and he takes his back, which is the Kimura trap in a nutshell. But he did get knackered in that fight and Gillespie got on top and pounded him out. I mean, the pace of that fight was ridiculous. On the feet, Ferreira's a lot of fun. Pressure, volume, and just overwhelming people. If you watch him beat up Anthony Pettis, Mehmet Taizimov, Rustam Khabilov, those were all big pressure performances. Dariush was able to take him down enough that he wasn't able to get the same volume going, but he was still able to annoy Dariush in that way. Gillespie was not at all on the feet, so it didn't really matter. But Matuš Gamrot, I was saying Matthias, but apparently it is Matuš. But Matuš Gamrot is a fascinating character. I think he's one of the best prospects to come into the UFC in quite a while. Was he undefeated in KSW? Yes, his first loss was his first UFC fight against Gurum Kutateladze, who did look really good in that fight. Got the split decision and hasn't fought since. He was signed to fight Don Madge twice, who, again, everyone's been like, where's Don Madge? But, weird that he's sort of disappeared off that really good win, and Gamrot got back in the cage twice in the meantime and got two good finishes. Scott Holtzman, he knocked out, and Jeremy Stephens, he took down and Kimura'd in a way that no one has ever done to Jeremy Stephens. Very impressive. The thing with Gamrot, you know, he'd been to ADCC and stuff like that, but he's a very strong wrestler. He's got good enough boxing. He boxed up Norman Park in a couple. Did they fight twice or three times or whatever? But he boxed him up. Decent power on the feet, but really what I love about his grappling is his dogged determination to get people down. The chain wrestling is really nice. And when you say chain wrestling, people think you mean like, push them to the fence, get the underhook, try for an inside reap, throw him past you, get the back or whatever. Or, you know, those sort of like combinations off the fence. I mean, chain wrestling, like he'll dive in on the low single or shoot in for a double or whatever. They'll throw in the whizzer and try and sprawl back on him. he'll arm drag them from the knees and come up on their back, which he did against Kuta Deladze. He uses the low single really well. I think it was, did he get Stevens with a low single that he came up on? He does the same thing that Roberto Satoshi does and Habib does, which is where you go in on the low single. They turn their knee down and away from you, trying to limp leg out, and you get the knee over the knee with one of your hands and try and come up on their back. And I think that's what he did to Stevens. It might have been Holtzman he did it to, but yeah, amazing, scrambly, chain wrestling grappler. And had a decent match with Gary Tonon at ADCC, which I always reference. But I think this is a very interesting match because Gamrot is a very honest sort of wrestler. He doesn't do an awful lot of cage work. Like, he doesn't prioritize it. Diego Ferreira likes to go forward so that people aren't shooting onto the fence, but has had, like, the Benil Dariush, a lot of his work was getting him down along the fence. And the same is true with Gregor Gillespie, actually, who also isn't that fence focused, but still did a lot of good work on the fence in that fight. So very, like, I'm intrigued to see how this goes, because I would expect Diego Ferreira to come out and try and back him up and then, you know, create scrambles as Gamrot shoots towards the center of the cage. Fascinated to see what Gamrot can do with a good high-level guard in MMA, because Benil Dariush and Gregor Gillespie, neither of them was able to get much going from the half guard, which is a typical, like, sit on the leg and pound them position in MMA. I really like that fight. And I hope Diego Ferreira comes in shape, because his conditioning was a real tool in that Mirbek-Taisimov fight, the Rustam-Habilov fight, you know. And it sort of let him down in that Gregor Gillespie fight. While we're on the subject, I was watching the Dariush-Ferreira fight, the rematch, I suppose, because that was their second fight. I keep forgetting they fought once already. But I was rewatching that yesterday, and there's so many hilarious instances of what I call a Chris Toyoni moment. Chris Toyoni is a referee who's been around forever, actually. He used to have, like, orange hair, and now he's bald. But Chris Toyoni, you'll probably remember him from, I can't remember who it was the other day, but he immediately deducted a point on a fence grab in, like, two fights. And we were all like, nice, everyone should do that. Or it might have been eye pokes, but, like, the first time the guy failed, he took a point. And you're like, yeah, I would appreciate more of that in MMA. But he has a fatal downfall as a referee, which is he can't change direction when he's moving. So there are a surprising number of fights, and I can't remember all of them, otherwise I'd have assembled them in a thread. I put a couple of them together in a thread on Twitter, where if he's reffing like, bantamweights or featherweights or anyone who moves a good deal, they inevitably run into him at some point because he's just standing like 2 feet off to their left and they'll circle and hit him. So in the Dariush Ferreira fight, Ferreira breaks away off the fence out of a grappling exchange and circles back out into the open. But he runs, like, his eyes are on Dariush and he's circling, he's running out to the side. And he runs straight into Chris Toyoni, who pushes him back in the other direction. Oh, and then there's a great clip from Halal Kelvin Gastelum, Hack Parast, one of his fights. Was it, who did he fight? Fuck. Oh, Munoz. Daniel Cormier. He shoots down on a Hack Parast, and Hack Parast sprawls back into the center of the cage, and Chris Toyoni trips over his legs and falls into the fence on the far side of the cage. Hilarious. But the Ferreira-Dariush fight was one of the most flagrant examples of it, not only because they ran into him, but then every time something interesting is about to happen on the ground, like you can see Ferreira or Dariush getting in position to start doing something, to start like a series of movements, and just as they're about to, Chris Toyoni will walk across in front of the camera and stand with, like, his whole back takes up the camera. And it happened about four times in this fight. I was going, how? I mean, obviously it's not the job of the referee to know where the cameras are. I can only actually get mad at him for getting in the way of the fighters, which he does regularly. But it's such a weird curse to be able to immediately walk into the line of vision of anyone and distract from the fight. Curse or gift? You got Gerald Meerschaert in another weird Gerald Meerschaert fight. He's fighting Dustin Stoltzfus, who injured someone's arm and got in off the Contender Series off an arm injury. Very weird. But then he lost the decision to a friend of the podcast, Kyle Dorcas. and then got rear naked choked in round one by Rodolfo Vieira. So a bit weird to have a guy on a two-fight losing streak with no wins in the UFC fighting a guy on a two-fight winning streak with dozens of fights in the UFC. But maybe there was a cancellation. Oh, okay, apparently Abusipian Magomedov was due to fight Gerald Meerschaert and pulled out. And he also has no UFC bouts. He's coming in and off a single KSW appearance. Interesting. I hope we get some weird, slow Gerald Meerschaert boxing. Another weird matchup here. Rowney Barcelos, who is very good. Very good. And I forget he exists. And it's my job to, like, know these people exist. But Rowney Barcelos is a very, very slick boxer, counterpuncher, kicker. Lovely striking. Decent ground game, but lovely striking. And, you know, that's not rare at bantamweight, but he's very good. And I think he managed four in a row in his first four in the UFC. Oh, no, five in a row with three finishes. And then he fought Timur Valiev in June of this year. And I think we raved about that fight. It was just really good technical striking from both men. Lost the majority decision, so that means one judge had it a draw. And just sort of disappeared. Like, he's not done anything since June. But then the flip side of that is that Timur Valiev, having beaten a very tricky fighter who probably no one else wanted to fight because he wasn't ranked and he was also winning all the time, has also done nothing since then. And both of them have had fights booked and cancelled. But luckily for Barcelos, they were able to find him this replacement, Victor Henry, who, according to Tapology, is the number one bantamweight in Japan. I have not watched any Victor Henry. His profile picture has him wearing the deep belt, so I assume he's the deep bantamweight champion. Does have a win over Kyler Phillips back in 2018. And Kanahara in Ryzen. I didn't even know Kanahara was still fighting. But yeah, that'll be fun. I mean, just watch for Rowney Barcelos' boxing. And if it doesn't work, you'll know the other guy's good. Justin Taffer versus Harry Hunsucker. Could not give less of a fuck about that fight, mate. Zajara Eubanks versus Melissa Gatto. Same there. Oh, Charles Jourdain versus Andre Yule. The spazzy striking of Charles Jourdain versus the even spazzier striking of Andre Yule. Yule coming off a pair of losses, Gutierrez and Ars. Jourdain coming off that beating at the hands of Julian Arosa. That should be a fun fight. I mean, Charles Jourdain is always interesting. That's why they put him on these cards. Raquel Pennington versus Macy Chiesin. Raquel Pennington is not interesting, and I don't know why they put her on these cards. Dontell Mays versus Josh Parisian. And then Matt Sales versus Jordan Levitt. Jordan Levitt, aggressively weird, and I like that. So that's your lot for the fights this week. Yeah, I think for me, Diego Ferreira versus Mateusz Gamrot, that should be main event, but you want eyes on it, so you put Derek Lewis in the main event. Thompson versus Muhammad, I'm not expecting the best fight in the world out of that. I'm expecting maybe Bilal Muhammad to scrape a decision and move further towards the title shot. Rowney Barcelos, always going to have my eyes on. And Victor Henry, if he can do anything against Rowney Barcelos, I'll be very excited for him too. Oh, and Darren Elkins versus Cub Swanson. I didn't even touch on that one. I forgot that was there. Darren Elkins coming off the win over Derek Minna, but he's also on a two-fight winning streak. Eduardo Garagori and Derek Minna, which is nice because he was having a really bad time of it. You know, he lost a fight to Volkanovski back in 2018, which isn't so bad now. It wasn't bad at the time because Volkanovski was hot shit. Lost to Ricardo Lamas in a fight where the get the fuck up guard was on full display. Lost to Ryan Hall, and I think that's where a lot of people were like, has Darren Elkins lost it? And then he fought Nate Landwehr, and Nate Landwehr, moving slow as molasses, boxed him up. And I think, you know, four in a row, I was convinced they were going to cut him. I think they did threaten to or something at one point, and he renegotiated his contract. There was a little bit of drama about that, I seem to remember. But he's now won two in a row. Both by finish. One round three, one late round two. That's what he does. I always quite enjoy when Dominic Cruz is covering his fights and he's saying with awe, like, he always does this. He always comes back in the second or third round or whatever. It's nice that he, you know, Dominic Cruz, a guy who's known for his defensive style, and I doubt if you paid him, he would fight like Darren. Like, if you paid him triple, he wouldn't fight like Darren Elkins. But it's nice that he still has like this respect for the insane way that Darren Elkins fights. And Darren Elkins can't fight another way. Like, he's kind of slow. He doesn't have very technical striking. He did have a cool little combination, which was like right, straight, stepping left, uppercut into left body kick, which he even landed on Volkanovski a few times, actually. But yeah, generally, you know, he's just sort of goofy. And he makes it work through his physical attributes and his will, which you have to respect. And Cub Swanson coming off the loss to Giga Chikadze, got blown out of the water very quickly, body kicks and ground and pound. But before that, he beat Daniel Pineda. In fairness, Daniel Pineda looked like he had about a minute of good work in him and then just like gassed, which was bizarre. But before that, it was the Crone Gracie fight, and Cub actually looked great. And, you know, Crone Gracie hasn't come back. That was a lovely fight, lots of body work, lots of movement, lots of takedown defense. And it was actually like a little bit of a resurgence for Cub because he was on his own four-fight losing streak. Ortega, Edgar, Moicano, Burgos. Gets that win over Kron. We're all excited. He takes a grappling match against Jake Shields and actually had his knee blown out by a knee reap, which is not something you often consider. You know, the danger of the knee reap is often that it is it's a prerequisite for an outside heel hook, but you can be completely safe from the heel hook, getting rid of the hands or whatever. And if they bend your knee in enough, it's going to put lateral pressure on your knee and fuck it up. And that's exactly what happened. If you watch that, it was Quintet, so it'll be on Fight Pass. But I seem to remember there was a bit of a bang and it was just gnarly. You know, don't let someone with like 10, 15 pounds on you hang on your leg while it's bending inwards. just general rule. I love this fight. I think it's a great veteran matchup. And I think it's, Cub Swanson does have a good gas tank. I have seen him slow down though, so that's exciting from the Elkins side. But Cub Swanson also very good at scrambling back up and fighting off his back, which, you know, takes me back to the Elkins-Lamas matchup. There are elements of Lamas' sort of get-the-fuck-up-guard thing that Cub Swanson uses, but he did get arm-triangled by Lamas while trying to use them on Lamas. So, what I'm really saying is I just wish Ricardo Lamas would come back. Anyway, those are the fights for this week. Let's do a quick question. Jimmy says, "Hello, Slacky J. I don't really have a question about technique, but a question about media questioning Zhang Weili's title run. Why are media members and the MMA community questioning Weili's title run?" Oh, that's the question. Here are some of the narratives. 1, elbowed Andrade in the back of the head, so that was a fluke win. 2, robbed Joanna of a clear victory, so another fluke win. 3, Rose dominated her twice, so she's not an elite strawweight. 4, her path to the title was way too easy, so she has one of the most fraudulent records in MMA. When RDA, Henan Barão, or even Carla Esparza lost their titles, there was no mention of the narratives that Weili seems to get. Why is that? Also, why do MMA fighters like Ricardo Lamas... Oh no, we're going to have some Ricardo Lamas beef here. Blame her for being a communist. I don't think she's ever spoken about promoting communism, but she gets blamed for it all the time. And then there's a picture of a tweet where MMA Junkie has Zhang Weili, Rose Namajunas' anti-communism remark crossed the lines, turned fans against me. And Ricardo Lamas has replied, "No, being a commie turned fans against you." Oh, nice one, Ricardo. Regarding like the narratives, a couple of those I haven't seen. I haven't seen people blaming her for or claiming the Andrade win was a fluke. Andrade ran chin first onto a very strong hitter. The crazy thing about that fight is that if Andrade just hung back, Zhang would have fought a tentative kickboxing match like she had in her last three. Robbed Joanna of a clear victory, so another fluke win. Close fight. I'm not going to complain either way. I was surprised how many people were like, she's unstoppable now after that fight. I saw a good amount of that. You know, going into the Rose fight, I feel like I gave Rose a good chance. It wasn't a fight I felt comfortable picking a winner in, but I remember writing a big like pre-fight piece or whatever, or maybe I just did a pre-fight video. Can't remember what I did, but I remember doing a piece. I remember doing something about that and people being like, "You wasted your time because Zhang Weili is just going to smoke her." I was like, I don't understand that. But the criticism that her path to the title was too easy and has one of the most fraudulent records in MMA. Well, she beat a lot of scrubs in China. That is probably because the Chinese MMA scene is not very lively at the moment, and even less so for women, I imagine. And then in the UFC, her fights up until Jessica Andrade were honestly not very impressive. I don't think they were at all. If you go to a close kickboxing decision against Danielle Taylor, oh, well, you can't see what I'm doing. I'm shrugging. I'm giving you the, you know. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is an argument that her record pre-title was not, was very impressive. She did not have a great run up to the title. She did, however, have an awesome title-winning performance, a good fight after that against Joanna, lost the one against Rose very quickly, came back, had an awesome war with Rose. So, you know, there isn't really an argument that she's not elite now. I went into the Andrade fight going, like, I'm not convinced about her. But, you know, you can be very good and not have fought great fighters. The fighting great fighters and beating great fighters is the proof that you are good. In regards to being a communist, I don't know. Why do people think I know this stuff? China is the big scary at the moment. You know, sometimes, well, actually in Britain, Russia is again, which is incredibly weird because both Russia and China have £100,000 contracts with the top papers to just put in fluff pieces about them. It's absolutely mental. The Telegraph, or the Tory Graph as it's known, will write like fear-baiting pieces about like, oh, we need to put more money into the military or whatever. And then they will also be taking £100,000 a year, which is an astonishingly low amount to sell your dignity for as a you know, national paper, from like the Chinese government to just write nice things about China or, you know, Saudi Arabia. That's Tony Blair's whole gig now, just shilling for Saudi Arabia. What I'm saying is, fucked up shit is going on in China. Lots of people don't get to speak out about it, as the Chinese tennis player, whose name I will not remember, has most recently done, you know. And then you've got the other side of it, which is like Jackie Chan, who comes out at every opportunity to like just spout the party line, and other Chinese people find him annoying for it. But then who am I to judge a one-party state when I live in a state where all but one of the papers are owned by Rupert Murdoch or Lord Rothermere? However, I will say that I've always had a distaste for booing people for where they're from. I've always had a distaste for cheering people just because they're from the same area as you, you know. I will say one of the funner experiences I've had at a live sporting event, when the Olympics came to London, we all just put our names in for everything, because you're probably not going to get the judo final. You're probably not going to get the 100 meters final, you know, but you will get some weird shit if you put yourself in for everything. And I ended up at the women's weightlifting. I know, weird, eh? The women's weightlifting was, firstly, weightlifting is a really cool event because you sort of, you get until your attempt, it's done like an auction almost, and you can say you're going to lift a weight and then say, no, actually, I'll lift a bigger weight later because you only get your three attempts or whatever it is. So I didn't know all the rules going in, and I was like, this is hype as hell. But the lass who won was a North Korean. And I think it was one of two medals they won that year or something like that. But obviously in the crowd, there's this feeling of like, well, she better win or they'll kill her family. Smug, smug. But she was already winning before her last attempt. She'd already got the gold and she went for a world record, and everyone was going mental for her trying to get this world record. And I just remember that very fondly as one of my top sporting moments, because she wasn't competing with another Brit or anything like that, so there was no one for us to cheer for. So everyone was just cheering for her, you know, from the nation that everyone considers like their ideological enemy and the rogue state, and everyone's cheering for her to get a world record. So I thought that was, yeah, just one of the happy moments that really showed me what sport can be. Anyway, cheers, Jimmy. Right, I reckon that'll do us for today. I've got some stuff coming down the pipe, so I'll show you when I get it done. Going to try and do some more frequent Filthy Casuals guides of the shorter variety, where I just rap informally over the top of some Outkast music. You know where to find all my stuff. You're a boy, and I will catch you on Monday. I hope some of this is kick-ass. I hope Ferreira versus Gamero goes three rounds and they both almost choke each other to death several times, because that would be awesome. I'm your boy, Jack Slack. Coming in £5 heavy and constipated, bless.